I talked some more about Wilson loops and how they appear in gauge theory and what their properties are, and by extension, how they have been introduced into a gravity in this Young-Mills-like formulation based on a connection variable, a gauge potential, with the view of using them in the quantum theory, or using them as a starting point for the quantum theory. And that is what brings you to the line of research called loop quantum gravity. So in a way, what one is doing is you know, something I, a possibility I alluded to when we talked about finite dimensional, the quantization of finite dimensional systems. I know I definitely have a non-trivial system with a non-linear physical configuration and phase space. And well, not just because of that, but on general grounds, of course, I know that I won't be able to quantize arbitrary phase-space functions. So now what I'm doing, I select a class of functions which have some nice properties. So they are based on these Wilson loops. And then I insist that I want to carry them and an algebraic structure, Poisson bracket algebra that satisfy, over to the quantum theory. And of course, then it is my task also to express any other interesting quantity in terms of those. As we saw, one of the nice properties of these Wilson loop functionals, so you should think of them as, of course, depending on the gauge potentials, but having an additional label which is a closed loop, or it can be some more, be some more complicated thing, like a graph that also has intersections. The nice thing is that they are gauge invariant. So as we also saw, I mean, you consider kind of group valued objects, and you take traces, and then if you do this properly, you end up with things that no longer transform under local gauge transformations. So in our case, these would be three-dimensional frame rotations that which act on this internal index. And then, of course, thinking about how to apply this to gravity, we need then to take care of the remaining constraints, just in the same way we saw had to be done in the geometric approach. Now, of course, this looks different, and you hope it, well, it looks sufficiently different, kind of to change what you have to do in more detail. So in specifically, now the wave functions you're working with, they depend on the connections, but they depend only on the connections through kind of Wilson loop type dependence. So they are, of course, they live directly, you could say, on the quotient space of the gauge potential modulo the internal local gauge transformations. And one has a nice, for these wave functionals, one has a nice, well-defined kind of a kinematical structure associated with a well-defined kind of intermediate Hilbert space. So it's, again, intermediate, because we are not yet done with solving all the constraints. So it's, you know, an auxiliary Hilbert space, but it's very nice to have this well-defined structure around. And what one can, as I very briefly mentioned to you, one can, in a relatively straightforward way, implement the three-dimensional diffeomorphism constraints on this space of wave functions. And essentially, it means kind of going over to functionals that only depend on diffeomorphism equivalence classes of loops or graphs or whatever comes into play there. But then the key outstanding problem remains that of the quantum Hamiltonian constraint. And unfortunately, this is a very big problem. So first of all, coming up with a suitable, well, with a good implementation, where we actually don't have a very good handle on what constitutes a good implementation, because it's very difficult, and no one has achieved this so far, to come up with a Hamiltonian constraint that would satisfy also off-shell the Dirac algebra, a quantized version of the Dirac algebra. Also, of course, there is a lot of, well, again, this we already noticed that this is an operator that, well, looked as if it had to be regularized, certainly in the metric formulation. The question is, well, what has to happen? How does one do this in the loop formulation? And how does one deal with many ambiguities that come in how one regularizes this thing? And, well, the upshot being that really one hasn't come to a solution that would be regarded generally as complete and satisfactory. And of course, even if you have a specific implementation of the Hamiltonian, you still would have to solve it. So you would have to find the kernel of the wave functions that are annihilated so that you can then construct what we call the physical Hilbert space. And you have to convince yourself that this solution space is, well, does the right thing or is sufficiently rich to capture all kind of interesting physics there is. Of course, all of these things are very difficult to make specific, I mean, to actually say what it would entail to have these nice properties. Now, so the difficulties associated kind of with this problem, especially with tackling the Hamiltonian constraint, have led many people to reconsider the virtues, which one maybe had dismissed too easily, of the covariant path integral approaches, with the hope of being able to maybe not completely circumvent, but to make the issue of actually solving the dynamics of the theory more tractable. And I had started talking about what one means by a non-perturbative implementation of the path integral. And what I did is, before finishing yesterday, was to preview kind of a number or to highlight some of the known problems that were already mentioned in connection with the perturbative treatment of the path integral, and which of these one is able kind of to tackle and solve. And of course, what is in the background of this is, again, sort of what I'm going to talk about for the last two lectures this week, is research also of the last kind of 30 years, various ingredients that people, various formulations and variations of formulations that people have been using to try and make some progress with this. And so we're getting started again by very briefly recalling our beloved non-relativistic particle and the path, how we got to the path integral formulation of this, and just list, you know, what the steps were. And then I'll tell you that, well, look, exactly the analogous steps we want to implement in quantum gravity, and this is concretely what it means, and this is how to do it. So here goes. Of course, we've had a brief discussion of that some time ago. The non-relativistic particle. So you remember I introduced the slicing in the standard way. So this is my kind of given x and t kind of standing for Euclidean space and time. And I was considering in the path integral, say for the particle and some potential, I was slicing the t-axis in equal intervals, delta t equal to some a, and I was considering paths that had fixed initial and endpoints, x0 and x1, and, well, or let's say x0 is x initial, and let this be some xn, some x final. So my slices run from, you know, I'm labeling the t slices 1, 2, 3, up to n. So the index on the x here denotes the slice I am at. And then, well, what I'm summing over are then arbitrary piecewise straight paths. So that is a specific path P that enters into the construction with the corresponding coordinate x1, x2. So you see why this constitutes a regularization. So it's a special type of path. And the only thing I have to give you are the locations of the intermediate points. So I just have to give you, in this case, n minus 1 numbers, and then you can draw this path. Of course, if I had an arbitrary smooth path, I would have to give you a whole function, namely of where this path is, you know, at every value of t, every real value of t in this interval. But what I'm doing here is something, you know, I discretize it in a way. I don't discretize the path, but I discretize kind of the dynamical degrees of freedom by just pinning them down here only on these discrete set of time slices. So a regularized path is therefore kind of just a bunch of numbers. Of numbers, and the numbers are, well, that is fixed, the x naught at t equal to 0. And then we have, well, the x1, which is the x, say, at t equal to 1, etc. xi is the x at the moment t equal to I. And the path here, so a path is piecewise straight. Or you could actually say it's piecewise flat, right? So it's kind of structureless from its geometric, from its curvature properties as viewed from the kind of embedding Euclidean space here. So now the non-perturbative prescription for kind of doing the path integral for the non-relativistic particle in a sufficiently simple potential consists of the following steps. So this is like performing the path integral, doing the path integral. So the first step is to set to go to Euclidean time. And you do this in order to convert kind of the sum over complex phase factors that appears in the path integral to a real valued quantity. So then we perform the path sum. I put sum in inverted commas because of it's of course in reality an integration. Let me nevertheless write a sum sign here. So path, so this is over all paths p that go from x, what did I call those? In to final. Well, I should have said in and out. Never mind. To x final. And then we have all these, well, what used to be complex weights are then converted to so-called kind of Boltzmann weight factors, which are real, of the particle. And they depend on the path. And, well, how do you get to this Euclidean version of things? Simply by substituting, making this substitution. And of course, one thing that, a crucial thing that happens, you had, of course, a p squared or an x dot squared term in the action. And now, of course, it will be converted to a differential with respect to tau, the Euclidean time. And it will pick up, therefore, a factor of I squared, which is a minus. So you get a relative sign swap between the potential and the kinetic term of your original action. Plus, because you integrate, of course, in order to compute the action, you have a t integral there that will also become a tau integral and get an additional factor I, which combines with the I that was already there in the complex weight to give you this minus sign, and everything being real.
Okay.
So what you then do, you do the computation, and that means, you do the computation, and then you take the continuum limit as this parameter A goes to zero. That means the subdivision becomes infinitely fine in time. So that's what's called a continuum limit. You let A go to zero, and at the same time, the number of steps go to infinity, and then you kind of extract kind of the object, you get kind of two leading order from this construction, and that is still now a real thing. So now to get back to kind of the complex, to the correct signature, kind of the Lorentzian, the true dynamics of the particle, you still need to weak rotate back. And, roughly speaking, it amounts to some suitable kind of inverse of this relation here. Okay, so one thing I have already highlighted in the past, or asked you to pay attention to, is, of course, that these paths there are not classical paths in any way. So they can be arbitrarily far, of course, from classical paths. They're very wiggly. And they're not themselves physical objects, right? So you shouldn't think of them as physical trajectories, and that is sometimes captured by saying, these are virtual paths. So I still have to superpose them and look at expectation values, which know about the ensemble of all of those in order to extract underlying physics. Okay, so our straightforward task is to do the same thing for gravity. Now, why am I insisting very much on presenting this picture here? So I'm concentrating kind of on the geometry of these regularized paths, because in gravity, you can apply a similar regularization, which turns out to be very convenient for various purposes. So coming now to the case of gravity, a path kind of in analogy with what we did there can be chosen as also a piecewise straight or flat, which I use kind of interchangeably, space-time or space-time geometry. And kind of the corresponding path integral will be over space times, or space time geometries, I wrote here. Let me call them G in square brackets, so to indicate that I mean the equivalence class of geometries already, that go from some G initial to some G final, where these are now kind of three-dimensional geometries. Should specify. And so the picture, and we still need the weights, e to the I, s. So the gravitational action here, depending on g. And because the picture you see people draw is, of course, now a bit more complex. I don't have just one-dimensional paths, but I should, I should draw four-dimensional curved space-times. But the schematic picture is the following. So here I have some three-dimensional final, a geometry And here I have the full space-time with its four-dimensional Lorentzian geometry. And then here I have some initial slice G in 3. So here this is a space-time geometry. And this is a spatial geometry. As is this one up there, of course. Now, of course, there are a bunch of differences with this particle case. So here, these paths, when I said they're piecewise straight, I was referring to what they look like in the with respect to the Euclidean geometry in which they are embedded. Whereas here, in gravity, in GR, and whatever we want to quantization we want to consider of this, the geometry is intrinsic. So there is no embedding space. So we just want to sum over these objects with their intrinsic geometry, independent of any external embeddings. So that is what, of course, what classical GR is about, the intrinsic geometry of four-dimensional space-time, the way it is locally curved. So here, note that we have an intrinsic geometry. And also, well, what turns out usually, what you need to make this meaningful, you must make a choice of time. But then also, of course, you're doing that within the geometry, not with respect to some exterior reference frame. So that will also be kind of part time as part of the geometry. It has to be defined in some intrinsic manner. And, well, in order to perform an analogous quantization program here, now I've written down kind of the Lorentzian version of this. Well, the first step is to define what I mean by piecewise straight geometries. And what I will mean is I'm building up four-dimensional curved objects by gluing together building blocks that are kind of by definition individually flat. They have a flat geometry. And only by the way I glue them together, they acquire intrinsic curvature. And the building blocks I'll be using will be higher four-dimensional generalizations of triangles, so-called symplices. So that means in reality, so my regularization will be of a similar kind, if you like, as was here. I will introduce kind of a coarseness of my triangulation, so essentially kind of the order of magnitude of these edge lengths that appear in this triangulation. And in the end, I will want this to shrink this to zero, but I will substitute a complicated field-theoretic configuration, namely a space-time geometry, a classical space-time geometry, by a finite number of data. In the same way as there, to get the piecewise straight path, I just had to give you, a bunch of numbers, a finite set of numbers. And the same will be true here. A finite kind of volume of a space-time geometry will be given to you as a finite set of numbers. And essentially, well, there are various ways of doing this. We'll see how this works out. But the philosophy is very much what it was here. Yeah?
I'm still not clear how, to say it straight, it means you connect the two points, its initial and final point with a straight line in time steps. And but here we're connecting two curved geometries with something, but what does it mean to connect them?
We get to that. You just identify things pairwise. I explained it with a simple example, and if you still have trouble, just keep asking. So that's kind of the next thing I want to explain. So how does this function? What are these piecewise square geometries? And how do they encode a curvature? And this is a very old idea in physics, and was first put forward by Tullio Reggio, a very famous Italian physicist, in 1961. And he wrote a paper, actually, that was called General Relativity Without Coordinates. And what he had in mind was to set out a calculational scheme. He was just interested in the classical theory of GR, which incorporates, you know, such a regularization. So you're just dealing with, you know, finite sets of numbers to describe space-time geometries. And then, for example, solve Einstein equations numerically. Okay. So what does this entail? Well, a representation in terms of triangles, or as one also says, when one goes to higher dimensions, simplices. So a simplicial approximation. I'll spell this out in more detail in a minute. Of kind of a smooth curved manifold. It's M. So where, well, you're thinking of in the continuum having a differentiable manifold and, say, a metric assignment, assignment of a Lorentzian metric in each point, that, so this is approximated by another set of discrete data. So there is T, capital T, that stands for triangulation. And what you also consider are the edge lengths of the edges that make up your triangulation. And this will be kind of always a finite set. So this denotes a triangulation. And let me sketch what I mean by a triangulation. Just for simplicity, I illustrate this in two dimensions. It's an object I get by gluing together triangles. So this is T. So what I mean by the triangulation T is just, you know, a set of triangles in two dimensions, which I have glued together, by which I mean I have identified edges pairwise. And of course, they have to match for me to be able to glue them together. And the edges have edge lengths. And, well, it's actually handy to give them edge length squared, because you want to keep your options open of later on making these Minkowskian, or Lorentzian, or that means time-like or space-like. And working with the squared geodesic lengths easily incorporates that as an option. So I have squared edge lengths, L1 squared, L2 squared, L3 squared. So I have to give you these for all the edges that appear in the triangulation capital T. So how does such a procedure, how does it encode geometry, by which I mean curved geometry? I mean, the curvature is kind of, well, the non-trivial local property space-time can have. So how are the geometric degrees of freedom encoded here? Well, in a twofold way, you could say. So first in what I will call the connectivity, it just means how I have glued these triangles together to form a larger whole. So the connectivity. Of T. And secondly, the kind of squared edge length. So that are these Li squareds that I've written down here. Now, this formalism is extremely nice in that it works in any dimension and in any signature also. So what are simplicial building blocks in various dimensions? Okay, starting with the very trivial, so in dimension 0, I just have vertices. Yeah.
All possible geometries, not just the classical ones,
yeah,
in general.
Yes.
But even if you just consider the classical ones,
yeah,
they are like crazy solutions of Einstein equations, like that, like balls for the,
yeah,
the time like curve, the space like curves, and that, things like that.
Yes.
Would that be a bit strange? Because those are like classical solutions,
yes,
so they were very important contributions for the pattern.
Well, of course, you have to see, of course, one thing you do is, well, for instance, what do you specify and what do you leave open? And what you usually do here, you fix the space-time topology to be a direct product. And that's what, I mean, this is what we'll continue to stick with for the time being. So that already includes some exotic possibilities. But then, of course, well, it's of course unclear a priori now what, which things you should be summing over, because certainly not just classical solutions. In fact, comparing with the path integral for the particle, you would actually expect the classical solution to make a contribution of measure zero. Right? So certainly in a non-perturbative setting, you would anticipate that something similar will happen. So that actually what contributes most to your non-perturbative path integral will be some quite, you know, crazy objects, I mean, from a classical point of view. And this is certainly something that happens when you do kind of non-perturbative sums, say, in gauge field theory. Okay, so it's not nice and smooth solutions that give you the major contribution to the path integral. And, well, what precisely you should be summing over, no one tells you a priori. So it's a little bit, well, you have to find out what the appropriate analog is of what, say, in the particle case, led to the Wiener measure and reproduced standard quantum theory, like you get from doing it the canonical way, say. Of course, here our task is much more difficult because we don't know what the solution is going to be, right? So, but the same time, I mean, it doesn't change that your philosophy is a similar one, and you don't really know a priori precisely what path integral you get, and therefore what physics you get, depending on what class of paths you are summing over here. So what I'm just saying is we are now setting up something that is much inspired by what worked kind of for the particle case, but of course there is no claim that this is a unique way of doing it. Not necessarily because you see one is also taking a non-trivial limit. And in this limit, anyway, potentially much crazier things can appear that are just a result of a certain limiting procedure. So again, also that, even if you implement a certain regularization and your geometries, the geometries that enter the picture have specific properties, it's not necessarily the case that, that they will continue to hold once you take a continuum limit of this theory. So let me just continue explain, you know, we are at a much earlier stage in the discussion, what the Simplician building blocks are in any dimension. So indeed, with zero, you just have zero-dimensional vertices. So there's not a lot. In d equal to 1, you have edges. And of course, the intrinsic geometry of an edge, I mean, there is no sense in which it's curved or not curved. I mean, there is no sense in which a one-dimensional line has intrinsic curvature. It just is what it is. I mean, it's just linear. Of course, this is different from the extrinsic curvature, of course. If I have a path embedded, then of course it might have extrinsic curvature. Now, in dimension 2, things start becoming a little more interesting. Then I have triangles. And now, really, a piece of information has to go into what the interior geometry is supposed to be of the triangles. And this is, as I said earlier, the definition is that individually they are flat. It just means there are pieces, well, depending on the signature, say I had Euclidean signature, they're just pieces cut out of a two-dimensional flat Euclidean plane. Yeah. If this, or if I had a different signature, say two-dimensional Minkowski space, this would be then a triangle kind of cut out of a two-dimensional flat Minkowski space. And so it continues in higher dimensions. The next object is a tetrahedron in 3 dimensions, also supposed to be flat on the interior. And of course, after that, you know, it's just kind of artistic impressions. How do you draw a 4 simplex? Well, so here goes. That's one example of a 4 simplex, etc. And I said, by definition, because the interior geometry is flat. It's flat. And this also means that once I've given you the edge lengths, I can actually reconstruct the metric modulo, you know, coordinate transformations on in the interior of each of these building blocks. Okay, so, and of course, and the length assignment is just a finite bunch of numbers, which, you know, as I wrote down here. So that's kind of the idea of how to generalize this prescription for the path, for the embedded path of the non-relativistic particle, to this more complicated gravitational model where we are interested in intrinsic geometry. And you see that, well, part of the beauty, you know, is just captured by this here. So you can now try and do general relativity with these regularized geometries, and you never introduce any coordinates. So all you needed to describe such a curved object where, well, what are the sizes of the individual triangles and how have you glued them together to obtain a piece of what one calls a Simplician manifold. So you usually also you have restrictions that you don't glue them together in a way that is too crazy. So you glue them together in a way that locally your space looks like an Rn, apart from possible curvature singularities, which I get to in a second. So So that's kind of the essence of the setup. Of course, if you wanted to, you could reintroduce coordinates. Now, the way you have to do this, because in general, as we'll see in a second, you know, there will be kind of curvature singularities appearing here, you have to do it on each simplex separately. But no one stops you, if you want to, you know, to introduce, say, on a triangle, to give a simple example, to reintroduce a coordinates and therefore an explicit form of the metric. Of course, the metric is, we said, is a flat metric. So it's the flat Euclidean or flat Minkowski metric. But of course, you, by screwy choices of coordinates, you can make this look very, very complicated. Now, the question is, of course, why would you want to do that? And in fact, of course, this formula has been set up exactly to avoid having to go to coordinates, to kind of to work with physical, directly with quantities that have a direct physical interpretation, so these lengths and gluing data. But nevertheless, let me just give you a small example of a kind of a single two simplex, how you might reintroduce coordinates and what this then looks like. So let's look at a single two simplex, which is, of course, the same as a triangle, a flat triangle. So let this be the triangle. And what I do now, so I'm now given the edge lengths, L1 squared, L2 squared, L3 squared. So these are the geometric data, but let me now insist that I want to reintroduce, for some reason, a local coordinate system. And of course, there is an infinite set of possibilities for doing this. Let me choose a coordinate system where this now is the origin and where these two axes span my coordinate system. So it's not an orthogonal system, as you can see, as the way I do it. But nevertheless, let me use this as a kind of coordinate system. So I have here kind of, I think this is my x axis, and this is here my y axis. Okay. And now I claim that in with respect to this coordinate system, I now have an explicit form for what the flat metric looks like, and I can express it as function of the edge lengths here. And it's of the following form, 1 squared, 1 half, 1 squared plus L2 squared plus 3 squared. And of course, it's symmetric. So this is the same, 1 half L1 squared plus L2 squared plus L3 squared. Sorry, this is the these are the entries. And then I have an L2 squared here. And of course, the fact that you have off-diagonal entries comes from you're using a non-orthogonal coordinate system. And you'll be asked to derive this metric in one of the exercises tomorrow.
So yeah.
I think you're right.
It's not in my notes, but I hope it's right on the problem sheet. I think, yes, I think you're right. Yes, exactly. So I still haven't addressed, so this is one possibility, but of course you can, you know, choose zillions of other setup, other origins, other coordinate systems, and then this will have a different form. Of course, the physics and the geometry is always the same, but you have it expressed with respect to another coordinate system. So that's, of course, the gauge invariance of the continuum theory, and which is so difficult to get rid of when you work with continuum quantities. Now, what I want to alert you to here is that if you work with these piecewise flat structures, well, then there are just no coordinates. So you're already kind of working with two kind of geometric degrees of freedom. It's like having kind of a sort of a scaffolding, you know, that describes your space-time. So here, of course, in two dimensions, this approximates or is meant to approximate or can approximate a curved two-dimensional surface. So the argument for how now curvature is encoded in these I still have to give you. And this works as follows. So again, it's simplest to start explaining how this works in two dimensions, so from gluing kind of triangles together. So what one then obtains is local, and of course it's intrinsic, so-called Gaussian curvature, that these gluings capture. And the form, the Gaussian, well, I hope you've heard about Gaussian curvature. So that is the way you define the intrinsic curvature of a two-dimensional curved surface, right? And it's kind of easy to visualize because you can embed these surfaces. You embed them in three dimensions. And basically what's a Gaussian, and of course you have, then you can identify the directions kind of maximal, minimal curvature. So you can diagonalize locally as a Hessian going with this. And the Gaussian curvature is a product of what's called the principal curvatures in a point. So this is kind of classical surface theory. And the interesting thing is that it's all intrinsic, although usually you derive this or you visualize it by thinking of it as embedded in three dimensions. But the Gaussian curvature you extract from it is totally independent of that embedding. So that is the type of curvature we're interested in, also in gravity. And now the form it takes on such a triangulation is it amounts to non-trivial, the existence, the presence of possibly non-trivial deficit angles. A deficit angle, I use that symbol delta, is a quantity which in two dimensions you associate with the vertex of the triangulation, and it's given by 2 pi minus the sum over all all angles that contribute at the vertex. So the angles that belong to the triangles that surround the vertex. I make a drawing in a second. And these you sum up. You add them, and their sum you subtract from 2 pi. So, and I'll illustrate it in two dimensions, but again, it works in any higher dimension also. So to be precise, what this notation here captures, this here, let me write it up here on the board. So this I here labels d simplices. So we are in d dimension. So it's a general case I'm defining for you here. It labels the d dimensional simplices, which share a common d minus 2 dimensional simplex. So when I say d simplex, I mean simply one that is, you know, a piece of flat d dimensional Euclidean or Minkowski space. And so the labels, this labels, the I here, labels d simplices sharing a common d minus 2 simplex, and that is also called, such a d minus 2 simplex is called a hinge for reasons which will become apparent, a hinge, and that's also why I call this little h. So these are all the I's that share the same h. So that's a somewhat abstract definition. Let me make this more concrete by looking at the two-dimensional case. So here, applying this, the eye labels two simplices, that means triangles, which share a common D minus 2 simplex. So in two dimensions, that is a zero simplex, that is a point. Right? So here we are talking about a sum over angles of triangles that meet at a specific vertex. So let this be some vertex of my two-dimensional triangulation. So connected to it is a bunch of triangles, and I've labeled them alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4. And imagine what I've done is, well, imagine that actually, well, these two were glued together here. And I've now cut it open to be able to put it out, you know, in a flat plane. And what then results here is exactly the deficit angle. So what I mean to say by this picture is, I've looked at a two-dimensional triangulation, I picked a vertex, and I found that there are four triangles which share the vertex. But if I add up the angles, what they give me is less than 2 pi. So if I think of it as in an embedding picture, it creates something that has a peak, right? And this, of course, means that there is curvature in this. So I've brought here my little demonstration. So these happen to be equilateral triangles. So you see, that's a piece of flat triangulation where these are all 60-degree angles. And of course, I can put it out in the plane. And the deficit angle would be 0 because the 6 angles add up to 2 pi. So delta is 0. If I now remove one of these triangles, so I glue things together this way, I have a piece of two-dimensional curved surface. Well, it's everywhere flat, but of course, at this point, there is non-trivial curvature. And if I now put this out in the plane, I have to cut it open to be able to do this, I find that there is a deficit angle of 60 degrees. So that is missing to 2 pi, and it's a direct measure, the deficit angle, of the curvature. So deficit angle 0 means no Gaussian curvature associated with the configuration. Any excess or deficit is expressed in a non-trivial delta. I could also, you know, glue in a seventh triangle. Then I would get a curvature of the opposite sign, and I would obtain something like a saddle point. That are different types of curved surfaces. They are a little special in the sense that individually the building blocks are flat, but the way I glue them together creates curvature, like here. And of course, it's intrinsic curvature, so it's clear that you are able to detect it from making measurements within the surface alone. So if you are a two-dimensional, you know, little flat, don't ask me, animal that crawls around in this thing, you can detect that you're sitting on a curved surface, for example, through parallel transport. So, you know, if you parallel transport a vector on any loop that surrounds this curvature singularity, it will pick up, it will appear relatively rotated after a single round exactly by this angle delta. So you can perform experiments within that two-dimensional curved surface to determine that it is curved. There is non-trivial curvature. And so in terms of these piecewise flat geometries, it takes on this rather simple form. Okay. So I hope the geometry of this has been made clearer. So if I have now sum alpha I equal to 2 pi, I have a kind of flat space. And say, if the sum sums up to something that's less than 2 pi, I have positive Gaussian curvature. curvature. And conversely, if it's larger than 2 pi, I have negative Gaussian curvature. And of course, what I can do, you see, my triangulation was given in terms of giving you the gluing and giving you the edge length. Of course, I can now re-express this delta as a function of my dynamical variables. Which means the Li squared. So it's all, you can just compute it, what it is, I mean, algebraically, like just using trigonometry, okay, what the contributing angles are by knowing all the edge lengths. So you certainly can compute this type of information. And so, you know, the very nice thing is that it goes through virtually unchanged in higher dimensions also. In higher dimensions, say in three, if you are in three dimensions, then we are gluing together tetrahedra that are flat. The curvature is then concentrated along d minus two symplices that are one-dimensional edges. So they play the same role kind of as the vertices played in two dimensions. So I have kind of curvature in a kind of delta function-like way along these one-dimensional edges, and I can again determine it, measure it by parallel transport. Okay. So very last, so what follows from this and how do you use this? Of course, you have to express the relevant dynamical quantities in terms of the triangulation data. And of course, more concretely, you have to take the action and re-express it as function of these edge lengths. But it's not straightforward, but one can work it out, and it was worked out a long time ago by Reggie and others. So so what you then end up doing is you rewrite what was the Einstein-Hilbert action of G mu nu in terms of these regularized data, the edge length, and that gets you to something that's called the Reggie action. So it's just a translation to this data, T Li squared. And for example, you know, one part of the Einstein-Hilbert action is, of course, the curvature term, a d-dimensional integral over square root determinant of g with the Ricci scalar. You have now to express it as a function of these data. And what it becomes in the discretization is a sum over all I element t, where you're integrating, sorry, you're summing over d minus two symplices, so you're considering the ith d minus two simplex. You take its volume and you multiply it with the deficit angle around this element of the triangulation. So in two dimensions, you'd be summing over all vertices, because the volume of a vertex is one, so that's kind of trivial, and you're summing them over all the deficit angles everywhere in your manifold. Okay. In higher dimensions, it's more complicated. In three dimensions, you will be summing over all edges. The volume will be their length, and this is multiplied for each of the edges with the deficit angle that ensues when you make a parallel transport around it. And, well, easier in a way is the representation of the volume term as it appears in the cosmological constant term, is of course just say a d-dimensional volume when d, when we're doing gravity in d dimensions. And this simply becomes the sum of the d-dimensional symplices, or rather the volume of the ice d simplex. And the key point is everything that enters here are volumes and angles. And these, by simple, you know, trigonometry, you can compute from the edge length, the Li squared. So this is now a prescription. You know, if someone hands you a simplicial manifold that enables you to compute the weight, so the Ragi version of the Einstein-Hilbert action for this specific curved simplicial manifold. Okay, to be continued.